Welcome to another broadcast of Crime Beat with Ron Chepsik, the show that puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Crime Beat brings you a lineup of dynamic and provocative guests who allow you to experience their lives and learn more about crime. Al Proffitt, the noted crime documentarian, says, quote, Crime Beat is the best show of its kind for the thinking listener, both entertaining and educational. Let me introduce the host of Crime Beat, Ron Chepsik. He is a native of Thunder Bay, Canada, and an award-winning author, documentary producer, director, publisher, and screenwriter. Ron is a two-time Fulbright scholar to Bangladesh and Indonesia, and is a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland TV series. Ron is also a former instructor in the UCLA's Extension Journalism Program. Three of Ron's books have been optioned for movies, and the Discovery Channel has licensed Ron's documentary, The Frank Matthews Story. It's Ron's books, Ron's travels, and Ron's interviews that make him a leading expert on the fascinating world of crime. Now here he is, the guy with the big picture and his finger on the pulse of crime, Mr. Ron Chepsik.
Thank you, Scott, for that nice introduction. Good evening, world, wherever you are tonight. Well, it's been really nice here. It's been as high as 82 degrees. Could you believe that in February here in South Carolina? But it cooled off today, I'm glad. It's too hot for this time of year, and of course that means the grass grows, and I have to start cutting the grass. So hopefully it'll cool off for a while. And our shows aren't going to cool off because we've got another hot one tonight. Barbara Casey and I will be discussing her book, her new book, Assata Shakur, A 20th Century Escaped Slave. Shakur, whose married name was Chesimard, is a political activist who was convicted of murder in 1977. 2 years later, she broke out of the maximum security wing of Clinton Correctional Facility in New Jersey and fled to Cuba. In 1984, she was given political asylum. On May 2, 2013, the FBI added her to the most wanted terrorist list, the first woman to be listed. Shakur remains a controversial figure today, a heroine to some, a criminal to others. So Barbara Casey, by the way, appeared on our show earlier to discuss her really interesting book on Catherine Kelly, the wife of gangster Machine Gun Kelly. We'll talk a little bit about that book and bring you an update on that, too. We will be with Barbara shortly. First, let's take care of some business. Our acknowledgments to the people who are helping to make Crime Beat one of the most popular shows on the Internet. First, I'd like to thank all listeners out there from around the world for tuning in to Crime Beat. We're thrilled and delighted to announce we had overwhelming positive comments and thumbs up about our program. Some of our shows are now averaging between 150,000 and 200,000 listeners every week from more than 140 countries around the globe. All shows are free and downloadable. You miss a live show, go to the artistverse.com website to listen to it. You can take our shows and post them on the web on any website. You can sell them if you can't. Remember to send us a check. I'd like to thank our sponsors, GG Media Books, for supporting the show. Also, thanks to our production people at the Artist First Radio Network, and particularly Scott and Tori, for making the show possible. Also, a special thanks to the Ryan Brothers for allowing us to use their great music for our theme song. It's got the beat to crime written all over it. Now let's look at the mailbag this week. We continue to get mail from all over the world. Some comments are long, so we edit them for length. This one is from Daryl of Madison, Wisconsin. Daryl writes, your show with the cannibal cop was fascinating. I may be naive, but I didn't know there was a world out there on the Internet focused on cannibalism and bondage. This is disgusting, but a man should not be sent to prison for his thoughts. Of course, Daryl is talking about Gil Valley and Brian Whitney's book, Raw Deal, The Untold Story of the NYPD's Cannibal Cop. And Gil Valley was sent to jail, not for what he did, but for getting on the Internet and scaring the hell out of people, including his wife, who turned him in. And it was a fascinating show. It raised a lot of questions about free speech and freedom of thought. And if you want to catch that show, go on the Internet to artistfirst.com website, and you can download it and listen to it anytime you want. We encourage you to continue emailing us with your comments and suggestions. Do that at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. That's crimebeat123@yahoo.com. Tell us if you don't want to use your name, no problem. So what have you been up to? Again, go to the strategicmediabooks.com website. We have several books out recently, including the book we'll be discussing tonight. And there's over 26 books on crime out there for you lovers of true crime, and I'm sure you love true crime because you're listening to our show. We offer affordable advertising opportunities for sponsors and authors. We have several packages to meet your budget. Contact us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. Let's take a look at next week's show. We have Matthew Richer on March 9. He's the co-author of The Mysterious Death of Kurt Cobain, Suicide or Murder. Kurt Cobain is, of course, the famous rock and roll singer who's in the Hall of Fame and ostensibly committed suicide. But there's a lot of questions about his death, and it's going to be a fascinating discussion. We hope you tune in. Now let's look at the news for this week. We call this a rap sheet part of the program. Our rap sheet features a couple of items in the news that have caught our attention and you might have missed. This one comes from Sandusky, Ohio. A woman was caught on video performing a lewd act. Guess where it was occurring? In a nursing home. That's right. This is what the woman, Brittany Foltz, who committed the lewd act, said. Quote, I am a very bubbly person. I like to make people laugh and smile, and anybody that knows me knows that, and they know I wouldn't do anything to hurt or humiliate anyone. Here's the controversy. The video was taken in December in the room of, get this, a 100-year-old man at an assisted care facility in Sandusky. That's right, a 100-year-old man. In the video, Foltz, who's only 26, can be seen mooning the man, and it appears she straddles his legs. She claims, quote, I never touched him. I was just joking around. The video was turned over to officials at the Assisted Living Center last week, and they contacted the police. Sandusky Detective Anthony Bass said he believes the video is disturbing. Bass said, the man has dementia. Foltz pleaded not guilty to a gross sexual imposition charge. I didn't know there was such a thing on that. But and her attorney claims she didn't break the law. All she was a little flirty, and the police overreacted. The woman claims that the man, 100-year-old man, is one of her favorite patients. She often plays he often would play the harmonica and joke around with her. You can't make these stories up, folks. A lewd act on a 100-year-old man in a old folks' home is just incredible. This one is also amazing, and we continue to report on amazing stories on social media. For 3 months last year, Michelle Hadley sat in a California jail, and she was accused of the harassment and attempted rape of her ex-fiancé's wife, Angela Diaz. The specifics of the allegation are astounding. Hadley was accused of posing as Diaz on Craigslist and soliciting men to attack her via, quote, rape fantasy ads. In January, the already bizarre case took a turn. Authorities said it was Diaz herself and not Hadley who had devised the plot and allegedly filed a false rape claim in an effort to frame Hadley. Hadley has since been officially exonerated. Diaz, meanwhile, has pleaded not guilty to felony charges that includes kidnapping, false imprisonment, perjury, and forgery, and is due in court for a pretrial hearing on March 3rd, which is tomorrow. Prosecutors said Diaz claimed at least three men showed up at her home, and one attacked her before she chased him away. None of the men were identified, but authorities eventually concluded that Diaz, who had initially falsely claimed to be pregnant, had devised the whole thing and routed the emails to disguise their source. Of course, the defense claims that Hadley is innocent, but it's just getting really strange on the internet. We just can't make these stories up, and we seem to outdo ourselves every week with that. Well, that's it for the rap sheet this week. We'll be back with our special guest, Barbara Casey, to discuss her new book on Assata Shakur. Scott?
You are listening to Crime Beat, the number one crime show on all of Wi-Fi radio. All past broadcasts are archived. You can pick them up at artistfirst.com. Now back to your host, Mr. Ron Chepson.
Thank you, Scott. Well, listeners, Crime Beat's featured guest this evening is Barbara Casey, the author of Assata Shakur, a 20th century escaped slave. The details of Assata Shakur reads like a thrilling novel, so let's give them to you. In May 1973, Shakur was involved in a shootout on the New Jersey Turnpike in which she was accused of killing New Jersey State Trooper Werner Forster and assaulting Trooper James Harper. This resulted in her indictment of first-degree murder of Forster and several other felonies related to the shootout. A member of the Black Panther Party, Shakur became a prime target of the Federal Bureau of Investigation counterintelligence program. When she joined the Black Liberation Army, went into hiding between 1973 and 1977, she was placed on the FBI's most wanted list for three bank robberies, the kidnapping and murder of two drug dealers and the attempted murder of two New Jersey police officers. In March 1977, Shakur was convicted of murdering State Trooper Warner Forster, as we said, and was imprisoned. In 1984, she was granted political asylum in Cuba, where she has lived ever since. On May 2, 2013, the FBI added her to the most wanted terrorist list, the first woman to be so listed. It's an amazing story to talk about, and we have Barbara Casey to do it. Welcome to the show, Barbara.
Oh, thank you, Ron. It's good to be here.
Great. Well, how does it feel to get another book out?
Wonderful. It's always a relief to get it wrapped up, get it published, and have it available for readers.
Right. And, of course, you made the switch from fiction, right?
I did. The Catherine Kelly book was my first nonfiction work, and I enjoyed the research of that one so much that I decided to try my hand at another one, and that's when I started writing about Assata Shakur.
Do you still like writing nonfiction? Which do you prefer?
They're both so different. I enjoy the flights of fancy in fiction, but I really do enjoy digging into the research of nonfiction and just being able to find things that I know no one else has read before and discovering new information.
They both have their challenges, right?
Yeah, it is. They both have their challenges, that's for sure. Yeah.
Right, and a lot depends on your personality and what type of challenge you like, I guess.
Well, I guess, and also in fiction, you connect with your characters,
right?
And with nonfiction, you have to find something that you can connect with the person you're writing about, and it's a little bit more difficult. You can't just make it up.
Exactly, you got to stick with the. Although a lot of people say. Most journalists, they make it up anyway, so, which, of course, we know is not true.
No, we know
that. But anyways, the book on Catherine Kelly has struck gold, right? You really got a really interesting development to talk about.
Well, it has. It's been optioned for a major film and TV series, so I'm excited about that. It's moving forward. We'll see what happens.
Right. Well, how does that come about? Tell us a little bit about that. People always wonder how a book gets turned into a film.
Well, actually, I had just completed a book review tour with Catherine Kelly book.
Right.
And apparently the reviews got the attention of a production company. And
movie production company.
They contacted me to discuss whether the... it was available for film if the option was available, and it just went from there. So I am just thrilled. I just am so happy about it.
Right. It's every dream of every writer to see their book turned into a movie, right?
Well, especially it being my first nonfiction work.
That's very unusual.
But so we'll see. I know that, again, the research in it, there were things in the book that no one knows. It hasn't ever been published before. In fact, there's never been a book about Catherine Kelly written before.
Exactly.
So I'm sure that all played into the interest.
Right. Well, where are we now with the project? When can we expect a movie?
Well, it'll be a couple of years because it's such a long process. You know, the script has to be written, and then they have to... line up the actors, and it's just a huge process.
Yeah, exactly. I'm in the business myself, you know, as a screenwriter, and I have a couple of my books optioned, and it's an incredibly long, laborious process, and you got to have a lot of luck.
You just don't hold your breath.
Exactly, that's a good way to describe it.
Right.
Don't hold your breath. Well, how did the book on Assata Shakur come about?
I just started looking into her life, and again, there wasn't very much written about her other than what she had written herself or her fan base had written. It was just a bit...
Well, in other words, there's a lot of information you have to be very wary of, right?
That's right. And I wanted to know more about... everyone knows about the Turnpike shootout.
Right.
That's what she's most known for. But I wanted to know more about her as a person, as a woman, and what in the world led her to that time in her life where she felt she had to commit all these crimes.
Right.
And it was hard for me to connect with her, to find that one thing that I could relate to her. And eventually I did, and that was, and when I did, then I could write her story.
Right, right on that. Well, you know, she's such a controversial figure, right?
She
you have
is.
You have the police, the law enforcement, they just hate her, and they want to put her, you know, want to get her back from Cuba and put her in jail. Then you've got her supporters that treat her as a real hero, you know, as a
yeah.
some a woman to challenge the system.
Right.
And you know, has paid a price for it, but still manages to stay free.
That's
so,
right.
Right. So is that difficult for you as a writer, knowing that in the back of your mind that people will scrutinize, you know, your words when you start writing about her? Whether, you know, whatever you wrote, somebody would be disappointed with it.
No, I didn't set myself up like that. It wasn't my job to draw a conclusion as to her guilt or not. I wanted to just to present as much information and the facts as I could discover them and let people draw their own conclusion is if they like this woman, if they don't, that's up to them. That's up to the readers.
Right.
But I feel when I finished, I felt like I had really accomplished a lot because I was able to find so much information about her that most people don't know.
Right, exactly on that. Now, she does have two other names, you know, which is quite interesting. Let's clarify that. Asada Shakur, where does that name come from?
Well, she was born Joanne Deborah Bryan.
Right.
That was her. And then as a young woman, she was married briefly. And
That was Chesimard, right?
That was Chesimard. And that's the name. Joanne Chesimard is the name that the FBI uses on all their posters and
Yeah, they refused to call her by her chosen name.
But when she started becoming radicalized,
right.
She wanted to change her name to something that she felt would reveal who she was and what her goals were.
Mm-hmm.
And she came up with the name Asada Olugbula Shakur.
Uh-huh.
Asada means she who struggles. And then her middle name means for the people.
Right.
And then Shakur is the thankful one.
Right.
So she gave it a lot of thought, and she thought that best described her role in life.
Right. Did that that came from African lore? Where did the name, is it African?
Yes, it's African. And at that time, she was involved with the Black Panther movement.
Right.
And she completely went through a metamorphosis. She got rid of her hairstyle and let it go natural. She started wearing the African dress because that reflected her roots, and she just started joining all of these organizations and that expressed how she felt and what she was trying to accomplish in life.
Well, she started off pretty normal, right? It didn't, you know, it didn't look like she'd become a, you know, revolutionary. She was born in 1947, July 16th, in Queens, New York, and she lived for a while with her parents and grandparents.
That was the thing that I was able to connect with her on was her childhood as a little girl, because her parents divorced shortly after.
Right, 1950,
born.
I believe.
And then her grandparents really played a huge role in bringing her up, and one aunt, as well as her mother, but the grandparents, the maternal grandparents, and they owned this beach property where it was Freeman Beach, and it was the only black resort beach that in the country.
Right.
And they had a restaurant and some other businesses, and little Deborah, Joanne, would go there during the summers, and her grandfather would take her to the library once a week, and she'd read the Bobbsey twins, and the grandparents tried to instill the values that were important to them in order to accomplish something in society. And they, you know, they insisted that she work at the restaurant even as a child.
Right.
And so She had loving parents, loving a loving upbringing.
Right. Very normal. Then, of course, that was in Wilmington, North Carolina, right?
Where Wilmington. So.
Right, right. She went, and then she came back to Queens again, which is quite a shock to go from Wilmington to live in a big city of New York, right?
Well, she was shuffled back and forth a lot back during that time. The grandparents actually encouraged her to go back to New York and be with her mother because they felt like she would get a better education there.
Mm-hmm.
And she was basically the only black child in the schools where she went, in their classes.
Mm-hmm. So how did she get along with her fellow white students?
I don't think she really belonged to any groups then. I think she felt separate. She felt separate. It wasn't until she started running away from home a lot. The first time she ran away from home, she was 10 years old, and she was living on the street, and strangers would take her home with them just to get her off the street and feed her.
Wow. She dropped out of high school. She was obviously a bright person, and she liked to read and all that, but she dropped out of high school, right?
She dropped out of high school, and it was her aunt, Evelyn, who insisted that at the very least she get her GED, which she did. She completed that, but she just had these other goals that she wanted to attain.
Right.
She didn't fit the mold.
Right. Well, let's talk about Aunt Evelyn. I think her last name was Williams, right?
Williams. Uh huh.
Yeah, and that was her mother's sister, and there's a nice connection there, right?
Yes, that's right. Evelyn was in law school and eventually got her law degree and started practicing as a lawyer. And when Asada got into all the trouble with the 10 different trials and all, she gave up her practice, gave up her life in order to defend her niece through all those trials. It's just incredible.
Why was that? Was it just love of family or?
I think she just, it was love of family, and she just was always very supportive of Asada. She always tried to help her. She was the one who, she also lived in New York, who would take her to the museums and to the cultural events and try to introduce her to the nicer things in society, hoping that she would fit in.
Mm-hmm.
But Asada just wouldn't, she couldn't. She just had...
She was a natural born rebel.
She was. She really was.
Right, on that. Well, what does she look like? Well, I see pictures on the internet. You know, she looks, I wouldn't call her beautiful, but she looks, pretty.
I think she's very attractive. And, of course, her hair is natural. The dreadlocks.
Right.
The more recent photos I've seen, she had short hair again. But she, for most of her time in Cuba, she wore it in long dreadlocks, and she wore the long
Asian
dress.
Well, she did get her act together, so to speak, and went off to college, right? She went to a community college and then City College of New York. And, of course, this was the mid-60s, right? What happened there?
Well, that was when she started joining different organizations.
Right.
That was really the start of her radicalization, because you have to remember in the 60s there were so many uprisings. All the college campuses were having problems with riots and protest and all, and Asada just loved it. She just was like a sponge, and she the more she could be involved in political unrest and that kind of thing.
Yeah, she liked the she liked the turbulence.
You did.
Yeah, I should add, Barbara, that I can remember the 60s. And believe me, I participated in some of this stuff here. Sit-ins, you know, it was the Vietnam War. It was a very incredibly politically active time, and you had to be a vegetable if you weren't involved.
That's right.
You know, in some ways, especially with the war, when everybody could go to, when all the men can go and get drafted and end up in Vietnam fighting in some paddy field, you know, on that sort of thing. But she was arrested for the first time, right, there, and it was a minor charge. I think it was trespassing.
That's right. And
that, then, and what did that do for her?
It was just like a badge of honor. She relished in it.
Oh, she relished that. She
it was with a group of students, and they were protesting something, wanting more black studies in on the campus or
right.
something like that. And but then that was when the Black Panther group started organizing, and
right.
she became involved with them. She
right.
kept going in a darker direction with each group that she would join.
Right.
She was
she a leader at this point?
Not, this was early on. She wasn't quite, but she was getting there. She
right.
was learning from all of them. She
right.
was learning from all of the different groups that she had participated in.
Right. Well, I found it interesting that, you know, she was an activist, she was her own woman, all that, and she's only 20 years old and she gets married, which I thought was kind of weird, you know, getting married at that age.
Right.
You know, when she had so many things that looked like she wanted to accomplish in life. What happened there?
Well, she thought that he shared her ambition, and because he was also a member of the Black Panther group,
right.
and but they knew early on that where he was still, even though he was he understood her goals, he still expected her to be home and cooking his supper in the evenings and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
That was the last thing on her mind.
Right.
So that marriage only lasted a little over 3 years.
Right. This was the 1960s. A little had changed
right.
in terms
That's
of
right.
gender relations, right?
That's right.
Right on that then. Well, she did join the Black Panther Party, and some of our younger listeners probably may have heard of the Black Panther Party. Talk a little bit about the Black Panther Party, why it was such a pivotal organization for black power advocates.
Well, when they first organized, they really had some good ideas. They were offering free legal clinics, free medical clinics, and free food programs for children, all for their black community. They were trying to raise the black community and provide services that wouldn't otherwise be affordable.
Mm-hmm.
But it took a turn, and in order to support all of these programs, they started robbing banks, and murders right. were committed, and things like that. And it just took a bad turn.
Right. Well, as pivotal and important a black nationalist organization, the Black Panther Party was, she left the party, right? And she went to the Black Liberation Army. Why did she make the change to the Black Liberation Party? And then maybe you could talk a little bit about what it was.
She felt like the Black Panther Party wasn't doing everything that it could do. And she, by this time, was very much into arms.
She was leading a violent struggle was the only thing that could
struggle,
be done.
Armed struggle was the only way to accomplish
right.
what she wanted.
I'm in Black Liberation Army.
Right. And that was when she turned toward the Black Liberation Army, because they were more of a militant group.
Right.
And they, again, she really grew within that group. That was when she became almost a leader. In fact, the FBI thought she probably was the leader of it at one point.
Well, this is interesting. We mentioned the FBI. There's a real famous program, Quantel Pro, right?
Yes.
That was involved with monitoring and some would say harassing militants and radicals across the country. Talk a little bit about that and her relationship to that program.
This was when J. Edgar Hoover was the director of the FBI, and he organized this control group, and they were to ferret out these militants and put them away in prison. He was afraid that if they were allowed to continue the way they were,
right.
that they would just create havoc across the nation.
Mm-hmm.
And because they were growing by leaps and bounds, and
right.
especially after Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated, then the groups really started growing
right.
in membership. And so they even had a special file for Asada, which was Chesrob, and that was just strictly a group of FBI agents were assigned to try to find her
mm-hmm.
because there were so many killings and bank robberies and just
right.
crime being committed, And more witnesses kept coming forward and saying, well, Assata Shakur was involved in that.
Right.
And yet they couldn't find her because she had gone underground.
Which is quite interesting. And, of course, the FBI did a lot of legal things, illegal things, too, right, with regard to that program.
Yes, they did. It was very questionable. And eventually, of course, it was disbanded.
Right. Under controversy on that. Well, let's take a break, and we'll continue our discussion with this amazing life of Assata Shakur, which is in Barbara Casey's book. Scott?
Check out the latest release from Sage Words Publishing, West Bobu Gold, by author Hawk McKinney. West Bobu Gold features strong ex-SEAL Craig Ingram and his beautiful, intelligent girlfriend, Terry Wolford Stanley, a woman he fell in love with and then saved from death at the hands of a sadistic murderer. The plot focuses on illegal poaching of relics by those selling to private collectors, but also involves a pornography ring that pulls in unsuspecting teenagers and a violent and crooked law enforcement officer seemingly at the center of it all. Craig is approached to come in and help figure out what is going on. Step by step, he unravels the mystery while attempts are made to tarnish his reputation and take his life. And the death toll rises. Hawk McKinney is an internationally acclaimed novelist. West Bobu Gold is book two in his Moccasin Hollow mystery series. For more information about Hawk McKinney's novel, West Bobu Gold, and other titles, please visit Sage Words Publishing. That's sagewordspublishing.com.
Hi, everybody. This is Ron Chepsik, the producer and host of Crime Beat Radio, which airs every Thursday on the Artist First Radio Network. I'm also the publisher of Strategic Media Books, which publishes the best in crime fiction and nonfiction. We have published such titles as Sergeant Smack, Scapegoat, Rogue Mobster, and Queenpins. Now we are proud to announce the publication of Black Caesar, The Rise and Disappearance of Frank Matthews' Kingpin. It's the story of the biggest mystery in organized crime history. On July 2, 1973, Matthews jumped bail and vanished with a beautiful girlfriend and $15 to $20 million. He's never been seen again, despite the biggest manhunt in DEA history. The book is timely because July 2nd of this year marks the 40th anniversary of Matthew's flight and disappearance. Black Caesar is easy to get. The book is available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local bookstore, and at the publisher's website. The book is also available in ebook format. For further information on Black Gangster and other great crime books, go to strategicmediabooks.com. We hope you enjoy Black Caesar.
You are listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First Radio Network. All past shows are archived. You can pick them up at artistfirst.com. Now back to your host, Mr. Ron Chepsik.
Thank you, Scott. We're here with Barbara Casey. Barbara is the author of Assata Shakur, a 20th Century Escaped Slave. Barbara, that's an interesting subtitle. Where does that come from?
Well, actually, Assata refers to herself as an escaped slave. And it's because she always envisions herself as a slave in society.
Right.
And so once, of course, she escaped from prison, and so she immediately referred to herself as a 20th century escaped slave.
Right. Well, the book is available everywhere, right? It's being distributed now.
That's right.
It's available at bookstores. If it's not in your bookstore, you can always order it. You can go to Amazon.com, which is probably the best place. It's available on ebook, right?
Yes.
And we got a lot of listeners in the UK. It'll be distributed to the UK and Ireland pretty soon, probably a month or so. And the ebook is also available, right?
That's right.
Right, on that. And what about the yourself? How can our listeners connect to you?
Well, they can go to my website, barbaracaseyagency.com.
Right. And, that's your other life, right? You're a literary agent.
Yes, true.
Maybe we shouldn't mention it because you'll get inundated with proposals.
I know.
if you're going to send anything, please look at our website to make sure you send her appropriate material. Right, Barbara?
Exactly, yes.
On that then. I know the answer to this because you're not my friend on Facebook. You don't use Facebook too much, do you?
I don't. I'm so busy with everything else. I just never did carve out a little chunk of time for my social media. I just haven't done that. So.
Did you tweet?
No.
I know. I knew the answer was a rhetorical question on that. Well, we don't tweet too, and I tell all my guests that about 95% of the guests on here don't tweet. which is really interesting because I wonder what it says about Twitter, because Donald Trump is the big
he's
the big guy and he lives on Twitter. And I know other people. There's several people I know, including friends, that live on Twitter, but I can't live on Twitter.
No, it would eat in too much of my time.
Yeah.
So I just don't.
Exactly. Well, getting back to our interview. Okay, so you have this student. She's the worst charge is trespassing. And then by 1971, she's at a hotel in Manhattan, and she's arrested on numerous charges, and she was shot in the stomach. What happened? And that's just the beginning, right? Talk a little bit about that.
That was one of her earlier crimes. She never would actually admit what happened, but the law enforcement believes that it was a drug deal that had gone bad, and she wound up getting shot.
When you say drug deal, you mean dealing in drugs or using drugs?
I think she was dealing at that point, trying for money.
To raise money for her revolutionary cause.
That's right. That's right.
On that, then, well, tell us about some of the crimes she was involved with, and we have to say alleged because she got off on most of them, right?
She did. There were murders and bank robberies were the most prevalent, and but she was indicted 10 times, and
10 times,
10 times in New York and New Jersey, and resulting in 7 separate trials, and they were either dismissed or acquittals, or there was one hung jury, and there was one change of venue, and then she got pregnant, and so it was declared a mistrial, and so the only one that really went to court was the Turnpike shootout, and that was the one that they convicted her on.
Right. How do you explain that she got off so many times? You can see once or twice. We're talking, 6, 7, 8 times, something like that. She got off
7 separate times.
Yeah.
And and there were even, and again, her aunt Evelyn was the one who was defending her, but they didn't get along. Asada was just horrible, and during the trials, she was so disrespectful to the court. She was, she would yell profanities and do other things that were just horrible. And so there were many times when her Aunt Evelyn would just walk out, refuse to even represent her. And Asada would defend herself. But she
wasn't qualified to do that, right?
No, no. But yet she managed. And just either there was insufficient evidence or in many cases, it would take so long to get the trial on the docket that by the time it got there, the judge would just dismiss it.
Right.
The witnesses would be gone. It was just a variety of complex reasons.
Right. Well, in one case, she was one of, I think, something like 4 suspects, and there was a handgun grenade thrown, and it destroyed a police car. That was in Queens, I believe.
Yes, and there were always things like that because it was again the Black Liberation Movement. The members, they would do anything to protect their own, and there were always, so there was a fear throughout the country because of this.
Right. Well, isn't this amazing? Given what we think of terrorism today, right? Yes. You know, we're afraid of, and people don't realize what the climate was like back then.
That's right.
You know, how tense it was and
right.
how divided. You talk about the country being divided today. You know, it was divided back then.
And see, these were our citizens, though, that were doing this. They,
right.
They weren't people coming from a foreign country and,
right.
and trying to it, they, these were our citizens.
Right. Well, everything comes to a head, what, in 1972, right?
Right, in 73.
Right.
That was, and then,
right, right. There was the confrontation with the two police officers.
Yes.
And when was that? That was in.
That was in the spring of 73.
Right, in the spring of 73. And tell us what happened at that confrontation.
Well, it was like 1 o'clock in the morning, and they were driving on the turnpike.
Who were they?
It was Asada, and then two black members of the Black Panther.
Right.
One was the Black Panther foreign minister, and then the other was a former member. And they were headed to New York. She told the police officers that she was going there to work as a bar waitress. But in the car, after everything, the dust settled, they found bags of false Social Security cards and
right.
identification cards and passports and things like that. So, but anyway, they a state trooper pulled them over for what he said was a broken taillight, and also they were speeding.
Was it a broken taillight, or is that a point of controversy?
No, that fact was true. It was. And then when he stopped, he called for backup.
Right.
And they don't know exactly what happened, but at some point, Trooper Forrester was the backup. And when he came, they had started shooting. And when they didn't even realize that Trooper Forrester had been killed until much later. And he had four bullets, two in his head, shot execution style
wow.
with his own gun, and then two other bullet wounds.
Right, right.
And
well, she claimed that she had her hands up, right?
She claimed she had her hands up and that she was shot.
Right, and she had some wounds, though.
She was shot and had to be taken to the hospital. And then there was a third patrolman also who was injured, and he was taken to the same hospital, but he
right.
survived.
And, of course, one of her people got killed, too, is Zaid Shakur.
That's right. And not related. But
right.
And, yes.
And he was driving, I think, the vehicle.
Yes, and he was her, who she considered her best friend.
Right.
And, yes, he was killed.
Well, here she is, and she's arrested, right?
Yes.
What is she charged with, murder?
Yes, and that's right.
And she's thrown in jail, and so who's going to defend her this time?
Her Aunt Evelyn.
And Evelyn comes back, even though they have this love-hate relationship, right?
That's right.
Right, and so she comes back, and...
But in addition to Aunt Evelyn, they amassed a huge group of attorneys to defend Asada, and William Kunstler, Stanley Cohen, and several others.
Right, real famous liberal lawyers.
Big-name attorneys.
Right, right. So she had a really really strong team, and she goes to trial, and what happened?
Again, she misbehaved throughout the trial, and the judge threatened to put tape across her mouth and handcuff her and all this, but eventually the jury wasn't out very long, and they came back with a conviction on all eight
right.
counts,
right.
Two murder charges and six assault charges.
Right. Was she a cause celeb at this time? At this point?
Oh yes.
Yeah. She was nationally famous, right?
She was.
Right, on that. And so she's going to jail, it looks like, for forever, right, given the crimes that she's convicted of.
That's right, uh-huh.
Well, we'll stop it there. and we'll pick up. And this is just we're going to go like what Paul Harvey used to say, the rest of the story. And right now we're going to have Scott, and we're going to take a break, and we'll be back shortly. Hi, I'm Ron Chepsik, the host of Crime Beat Radio, and I'd like to tell you about another exciting and timely book from Strategic Media Books that is shaking up the publishing world. Rob J. Anderson's Tarnished Heels, How Unethical Action and Deliberate Deceit at the University of North Carolina Ended the Carolina Way, is an explosive investigation of the athletics program at the University of North Carolina. The book seriously questions the University of North Carolina's sterling reputation, both athletically and academically, and chronicles numerous events that have negatively affected the University of North Carolina. Players, coaches, faculty, and university leaders all played roles in the scandal, and many cases appear complicit. The uncovered issues are staggering. Cash payments, academic misconduct, fraudulent classes, grade tampering, corruption in the coaching ranks, and much more. Along the way, doubts were also raised as to the effectiveness of the NCAA to properly and fairly handle the multiple situations. Tarnished Heel shows that the University of North Carolina remains in moral limbo, and still not willing to truly examine the depth of the issues that have negatively affected its campus academics and revenue sports teams. For more information about Rob J. Anderson's Tarnished Heels and other titles, please go to www.strategicmediabooks. That's www.strategicmediabooks.com. Thank you.
If you have a question or comment for Crime Beat, send it to us at Yahoo123. Crimebeat123@yahoo.com. Rather, now back to your host, Mr. Ron Chepsik.
Thank you, Scott. You'll get it right there. We're with Barbara Casey, author of Assata Shakur, A 20th Century Escaped Slave. The book is just came out a couple weeks ago, and it's everywhere. As you can see, it's an amazing story. Get it on ebook. Get it to your bookstore. Get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's available in England, we hope, because we are the publisher of the book, Strategic Media Books. We hope it will be international eventually on that. Barbara has a website. Your website, Barbara?
BarbaraCaseyAgency.com.
And she doesn't use Facebook because she's too busy, and doesn't tweet either, which we'll excuse because most everybody on the show doesn't do that either on that. And anything you wish to add, Barbara, before we get back to our interview?
No, I'm having fun.
Okay, that's good. Well, we are. We all, and time's flying when you have fun, too.
Yes.
So we're going to have to speed it up here. So, okay, so this is where the story should end, right? She should be in jail for the rest of her life, but she escapes. What happened?
She escapes
from prison.
She escaped on Black Solidarity Day. She'd been in prison for... she'd been incarcerated for 6 years, but not actually in prison, but 3 years, and she escaped, and just disappeared. She disappeared, and then in 1984, she wound up in Cuba, and where she had been granted political asylum.
You mean to tell me they did a national manhunt, right?
National manhunt, and of course now, when she was with the Black Liberation Movement, one of her main jobs was working with the underground.
Right. Oh, so there was a well-established underground.
She knew what to do, and she had all these supporters helping her with money and everything she needed. And her code name was Cleo, and she stayed hidden from the law enforcement.
For about, what, 5, 6 years?
5 years. And then she showed up in Cuba.
Well, how do you get to Cuba? I mean, to me, that's really interesting. I mean, by boat or by plane? I mean, how do you end up, could she possibly get out of the country, go to a third country, and make it to Cuba?
Yes.
I'm just curious,
is there
any evidence of how she got there?
In this case, she did. She went to some other islands, and then from there went to Cuba.
Well, you have to think this is an incredibly sophisticated underground.
They had it all planned out. They knew exactly how to do it. And the reason, because they had been successful with others who had escaped to Cuba as well.
Exactly. Well, here she goes to Cuba, and they welcome her with open arms, right?
They do. In fact, she's a celebrity there, and they give her free housing. They give her an allowance. She doesn't have anything to worry about. Everything is paid for. In return, she serves like a hostess for the delegations of international visitors.
Right.
And she talks about human rights violations and political prisoners.
So they use her as political propaganda.
That's right. And she was a teacher there. And
editor on a radio station, right?
That's right.
In English language?
That's right.
Right, on that. And so they found good use for her. And meanwhile, the New Jersey State Police are not very happy, right?
No, they're not. They're doing everything they can trying to get her back. And this has been going on up until the present day. Governor Chris Christie in New Jersey, he's still writing letters and making demands. And Senator Menendez, he's doing the same thing. They're doing everything they can. And, of course, now that Fidel has died, and Fidel is the one who welcomed her with open arms.
Exactly,
and now
exactly.
It's his brother who is carrying on that torch. And they're having to work with Raul, but still they haven't. Raul is still refusing.
Right. Well, we were talking between the during the commercial. It's really amazing because everybody thought after Castro's death, the whole system would crumble, right?
Yes.
In Cuba, and nobody's talking about Cuba, which is good, of course, for Assad Shakur, right?
Right, because and what has happened, there's now a $2 million bounty on her head. And before the relations thawed between our country and Cuba, the Cuban people didn't even know about it. They barely knew that she was over there. They didn't know who she was, or they didn't really care. And now they all of a sudden they're hearing all this. The newspaper, they're getting more free newspaper, and they're learning all this stuff from our country, and they're finding out that there's a woman over there with a $2 million bounty on her head. So there's this fear that... she's afraid not only is the FBI going to capture her and make her go back to prison, but the Cuban people might kill her because for their money.
Well, yeah, it's $2 million, and, you know, it could be arranged.
That's right.
Yeah, right. So do you think she's underground in Cuba, ironically?
Up until 2014, you could go to the phone book in Cuba, in Havana, and look up her number. Then all of a sudden she just disappeared. So the Cuban government has been keeping her hidden at different locations. She's not in just one house anymore.
So they move her around.
They move her around, and she has bodyguards. But no one knows where she is. No one has seen her because now she's living in fear.
Right. And, you know, she's not really technically, she's not free, really.
Not now.
No, I mean, you know, she's living it psychologically. She's every minute of her day.
That's right.
You know, is spent worrying if someone's going to turn her in, or there's a plot to do it. And there was a plot, right, or attempted plot that we discovered with a lawyer, right? Talk about that, which is really fascinating.
Let's see now, which one? Because there have been so many.
This one with the lawyer, Bill. The one I introduced you to, remember?
They had it all planned out how they were going to capture her,
kidnap her,
and remove her from the island.
Right.
They had the everything set up, and then at the last minute it fell through. And that seems to be the way it happens. Somehow she finds out, or she's informed, and they move her. Or it just doesn't work
right
out. They haven't been able to do it.
Right. I didn't want to mention the lawyer's name, you know, because on that. But that told us about this plot. But you figure that $2 million is a big incentive for bounty hunters, right?
Well, it's,
you know, like ex-CIA, you know, or intelligence officers, you know, to get involved in some kind of plot to kidnap her. And there's probably people in Cuba that would be willing to work with them because of the money involved.
Well, they would, and that's now what's driving her fear.
Right. Well, what's interesting is she's just one of what? How many are there like fugitives like her? Like
the last count was about 70. There's still 70 fugitives there that are living in exile. And they, you know, the latest thing, as recently as June of last year, our government was trying to work out an exchange deal where we would return one of their political prisoners that we have in prison here to Cuba in return for Assata Shakur. And
was it serious?
Yes, yes.
Oh wow!
But it hasn't been acted on.
Right. Do you think she's even in Cuba, given that?
I've given this so much thought, and the fact that no one, even her closest friends over there, don't know where she is, or at least that's what they say, I just wonder if she hasn't already left. Because once the information about the $2 million bounty became known, she had to realize that her days were limited.
Right.
And I wouldn't be surprised if she hasn't moved on to another country and is living in exile somewhere else now.
Wow, yeah. Well, she's almost 70.
She is.
You know, so how's her health?
The last that we know, she's healthy.
And right.
She's a grandmother, but all of this,
right.
her life, prevents her from
right.
enjoying her grandson
right.
and her daughter.
Right. Do you think she'll ever be brought back to the U.S. for trial? We've only got like a minute left, so we're going to have to hurry here.
If she's still in Cuba, I think she will be. I think she'll be brought back.
Oh, you will on that? So. On that. Well, that's really interesting, and the story's not over yet, right?
It isn't. It's still going on. It's just as important today as it was back
right.
during the trial.
Well, our show is over. We've reached the end here, and we wish you really a lot of success with the book, and thank you so much for coming back on.
Oh, thank you.
And we hope you stick with nonfiction, so we could get you back on for another show.
Thank you, Ron.
Thank you then. Have a great evening, Barbara.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Wow, that was really fascinating. Amazing story. Just a reminder for all you listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for March 9, 2017. We have Matthew Richard, the co-author of The Mysterious Death of Kurt Cobain, Suicide or Murder. We hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we'd like to thank all of you out there for listening to our broadcast. In the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com, and please spread the word about our show. And until next week, we hope you tune in to Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you'll want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Sleep tight, everybody.
This is Robert Kramer. Join me here on Artist First the second Wednesday of every month for The Robert Kramer Show at 11 p.m. 10 Central here on the Artist First Radio Network.